I plan to go to law school after I graduated, but, looks like my folks won't have enough money to put me through college.
Well, the world needs ditch diggers, too.
Entrepreneurship, scaling business plans. Then I became the CEO man. Are you ready to be mentored by some of the best minds in entrepreneurship in the world? Then you're listening to the right podcast, Ditch Digger CEO. We're going to be interviewing CEOs and founders who will be telling their amazing rags to riches stories. These entrepreneurs who dominate the industries they serve will be sharing the secrets to their success. We'll be talking to millionaires and billionaires. Many who started with nothing. You're going to be mentored with golden nuggets of shared experiences from my guest, whose time is worth thousands and even tens of thousands of dollars per hour. I started in the paving business right out of high school, and with no college education, mentorship has been my education of choice. I started over 25 companies in the last 20 years, have generated over $1.5 billion in revenues. My guarantee is this. If you listen to Ditch Digger CEO and you want to be more successful, you will become more successful. The secrets of my success and for many of the world's greatest business leaders will be revealed. Let Ditch Digger CEO mentor you.
Welcome to Ditch Digger CEO today. We've got, again, man, what an awesome, awesome guest we got today, Q. This friend of mine, I believe... when you just raise your hand and get involved in stuff, like there's a new chapter of YPO. And this is 5 years ago, seven years ago now. And it was a new chapter where we said, let's get this, instead of WPO gold, let's just get a new type of WPO gold, which would be, you know, YPO turns into World Presidents Organization after 50. And it gets pretty old at 50, after 50, because it's not just you're a 50-year-old, you're a 50 to 90-year-old, maybe 95-year-old.
Wow.
Which is kind of cool because you're meeting a lot of really neat people, old entrepreneurs, old business leaders, and it's fun to be around them as mentees and mentors and all that. But we decided we were going to do something different. Something, you know, we wanted active CEOs and active entrepreneurs to be part of this new chapter. And a group of us started this thing, and it's basically YPO Gold. But it was between 50 and 60 year olds.
Mm.
And I was actually 47 or 8, I think, my wife and I, when we got this thing started. And Ray and his wife Cindy were part of this. So when I say, you know, it's a blessing. When you raise your hand and just get involved in stuff on a constant basis, you get to be really busy, but you meet some amazing people. And so one of the first couples we met were this character of a couple. Ray and Cindy. I mean, they stood out right away as the most fun people you could ever be around. Within minutes, we couldn't get away from them. We were so attached to them, Cheryl and I. And so again, we've become very, very good friends. Some of our best friends as a couple, Cheryl and I. These two are our top few friends in our lives right now, and we do a lot of growth. So Ray not only is a great business leader, he's very philanthropic, does some cool stuff. So you want to introduce Ray Nicewander, my buddy.
Thank you, Gary. It's great to be here.
You know what? We're blessed to have you here, brother. It's going to be fun to talk about your journey and everything you've done. You're an inspiration to so many people, and the inspiration will continue on with this. So I'm excited. So we're just go ahead and introduce yourself quick. How about who you are, where you live, your family, just a couple of quick things about family and your life.
Sure. So Ray Nicewander, I'm the chairman and CEO of a family business called Raynor Garage Doors. We're based in Dixon, Illinois, which is about 100 miles straight west of Chicago, in the north of Illinois, but definitely rural area from Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And I represent the third generation in a family business. It was started by my grandfather,
wow,
Ray Nicewander Sr., back in 1929. He started a woodworking company, and it was just a cabinet making shop, very humble beginnings in a rented space that was kind of nothing. And he built a company from that.
Where was that space? That was in
Springfield, Illinois. Springfield. In fact, the original company was called Capital Woodworks, and the capital was from the state capital, Springfield.
Oh, okay.
So very humble beginnings. And then eventually the company migrated up to Dixon, Illinois. There's a story behind that that I'll get to. But
Dixon, the land of our one of our favorite presidents, Ronald Reagan.
It's known to be Ronald Reagan's boyhood home. Mm-hmm. He was born in a even smaller little village called Tampico, but was raised in Dixon from like the age of 4 or 5 years old. So we like to think of him as our hometown son, and really an inspiration too.
Really quick, off, and I go off on tangents sometimes, Ray. So you got, you know, cue, and sure, you can get us back on in a second. But you know, I never forget. We had a job working at the prison out there about 10-12 years ago, and the job was going bad. So we bid the job for X hundreds of thousands of dollars, and a weekend we got about 5% of the work done. It was supposed to be 50% done, probably, right? And my superintendent at the time, Jamie Nicolai, my buddy, was out there telling me how bad things were going and why we just couldn't get anything done. And so I said, doggone it, you know, this is the perfect opportunity to show my guys I know what I'm doing. So sure enough, I drive out there, get a room in a hotel out there, and I take over the job. And so I'm out there running the job in the prison out there in Dixon. And in the hotel, I'm reading the history of Ronald Reagan, because in the hotel out there, there's, sure, a mural on the wall, yep, talking about the lives he saved and all that. It was really fun. But the moral of the story is we got the job done, didn't lose too much money. I think we pretty broke even, got it done faster than normal because I lit a fire underneath the guards that wouldn't move for us fast enough to get us from one gate to another as we were paving different areas of inside the prison. But funny thing was, I was working one day, I'm raking asphalt one day, and I hear, "Rabine!" And I'm looking around, and it's coming out of this crowd of prisoners about 50 feet away from me, right? "Rabine, is that you?" And it's an old friend of mine I used to shoot in pool tournaments with. And his name was Gary, Gary Bannis, and he was a really good pool player. And I'm like, "What are you doing here?" He goes, "What are you doing here?" I said, "How'd you get here?" He told me the story, but unfortunately, he had some time to do it at mm-hmm. Dixon Prison. But it was quite an experience. I'll never forget the experience. I'll never forget the stories about Ronald Reagan.
Sure.
I learned while I was there, as well as working inside the prison was quite an experience. But just a backstory, but the prison system there is pretty high security.
It is. It's become higher security over time. It started out, I think, minimum, and I think now it's medium security facility.
So Dixon is where he became. So where did this whole story start? Your grandfather.
So with my grandfather, he got his first big break, really during World War II, and they took over his little woodworking shop and made it an ammunitions crating factory. And so he got a contract with the government and started building crates for ammunitions to support the war effort. And that really kind of got him into a production frame of mind. And then post-war, he had this opportunity where he was making wood garage door sections for other manufacturers spread around the Midwest. One was a company in Rockford, Illinois called Barber Coleman, part of the Coleman family.
Huh. Coleman like
lanterns,
camping stuff?
Yep, mm-hmm.
Wow.
And so they had a company called Barcole. So just like Raynor, where you take two names and blend them together to create a name, Barcole was a door company based out of Rockford. And there were a few others scattered around the Midwest, and we started building wood garage door sections as sort of an OEM source for these other small companies.
Mostly residential then at the time, huh?
Residential and commercial. I mean, at the time, everything was made out of wood.
Okay.
So the way the story goes is my grandfather was on a train to Minneapolis to go to a lumberman's convention where they would go and buy wood. They would do contracts for lumber, which was all shipped by rail, mm-hmm. and they would buy like a year's supply of lumber at a time. And he met a guy that was based out of Quincy, Illinois, whose last name was Norberg. And Mr. Norberg ran a little garage door company in Quincy, and he was a metallurgist and really knew how to bend metal, how to stamp metal. So you put all the hardware and the track and spring systems of a garage door mm-hmm. together with the wood sections, and you have a garage door product. And they got together. They took the Nor out of William Norberg's name, and they took the Ray out of my grandfather's first name, and they created Ray Nor. And it was this little company that started in Quincy. Around the same time, my grandfather, as he started to have success in business, his real personal passion was flying, and he loved airplanes. Mm-hmm. And so he bought a little airplane, and he used to fly around the Midwest predominantly. And he would just land in any small town and poke around and see if there was someone who wanted to get into the garage door distribution business by, you know, being their dealer. Uh-huh. And selling, installing, and servicing garage door products.
So he would go after anybody in business, anybody that had a shop in the
lumber yards, anything that made sense, right? And he started building this little dealer network. Well, over time, after a couple of years of this, Mr. Norberg, who's back in the factory running things, sees my grandfather running around the country in his airplane. It looked like a big party, mm-hmm. setting up this dealer network. And they had this agreement that if they ever didn't agree in business, that one could offer to buy out the other.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And then it became kind of an auction. Then the other could counteroffer, mm-hmm. until someone, you know, had the higher bid. So Mr. Norberg approached my grandfather to buy his share of the business out, and my grandfather countered. And I don't know how many times they went back and forth, but eventually my grandfather bought out Mr. Norberg's share.
Oh, wow.
Which my dad and I were real happy about, because otherwise you might be talking to somebody named Norberg today instead of Nice Wander.
Yeah.
So
what year was that, Ray?
That would have been 1948-ish.
Wow.
And so my grandfather then said, I don't want to stay in Quincy because all that employee group.
Where's Quincy on the map?
It's right on the Mississippi River.
Okay.
And it was supposed to be St. Louis before St. Louis was St. Louis.
Oh, okay.
And it was supposed to be Minneapolis, St. Paul. I mean, a lot of European immigrants, especially Germany, Poland, and Hungary, ended up in Quincy, Illinois. So they brought all these European skills with them, especially in metal bending and metal, mm-hmm. forming. But as trade developed, the boat kept going north to Minneapolis and bypassed Mississippi, and it was kind of one of these little river towns that was stuck in the middle and never really developed. But mm-hmm. it's a thriving little Mark Twain style river town, located just north of St. Louis.
What's the population today, Quincy?
I would be guessing, but I would guess around 20,000,
okay.
maybe. There's a Quincy private college there, Quincy College.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
So my grandfather then said, I need a new home for Rainer. And he started looking around the Midwest, and he said, I either want to be close to St. Louis or close to Chicago. I need to be close to a major city, mm-hmm. to which I can, you know, draw raw materials from,
yeah.
and then have a market to sell into.
Okay.
And so he ultimately settled in Dixon as a suburb, you know, kind of a rural suburb of Chicago, but with a good small town farmer kind of work ethic.
Sure.
So he set up shop in Dixon in about 1948, and then we've been building this door company ever since. Now, also, as kind of a parallel track to this entrepreneurial grandfather that I had, he never moved to Dixon. He always remained in Springfield. And as part of his love of flying, as he would run around the country, he saw this emerging interstate highway system being, mm-hmm. built beneath him.
Sure.
And it was a really amazing thing to, you know, we had the railroads in the early 1900s, and then right after World War II, we started building this interstate highway system, and so much of it went right through the heartland, through Illinois, mm-hmm. and the surrounding area. And as part of this emerging highway system, he saw these really neat roadside hotels being built for the first time, all under one brand, a national, mm-hmm. branded hotel. And this traces the roots of the Holiday Inn story.
Get out of here.
Which was born out of Memphis, in Tennessee, by a real entrepreneurial guy, a guy that was like Gary Rabine before there was ever a Gary,
Gary Rabine.
Rabine.
Okay.
All a right. serial entrepreneur, this gentleman, Kemmons Wilson, who built the first Holiday Inn in Memphis in 1952. And my grandfather, you know, it was, you know, it's the old real estate, you know, adage that it's location, location, and location.
Is it still there? The first Holiday Inn?
The first Holiday Inn was, it was, sadly, it was, became obsolete, as old hotels do, mm-hmm. and was torn down in, I think, the 90s, maybe. There's a plaque that commemorates the site. So my grandfather, you know, took his plane down to Memphis, and he went to meet with these guys that were developing this and said, how does this hotel thing work? And he got the franchise rights to Central Illinois.
Oh, man.
And built the first Holiday Inn in the heart, you know, in the heartland in Springfield.
Wow.
On Old Route 66 that started in Detroit and ended up in L.A. and went right through Illinois and onto St. Louis. So we built, he built the first Holiday Inn in Illinois in Springfield and was kind of on the ground floor of this emerging.
This is the early 50s, basically?
This would have been, I think he built his in maybe 1956.
Okay.
So 3 or 4 years into the franchising of, you know, and franchising back then wasn't a big thing. So he was kind of inventing franchising in a big way at the same time.
Absolutely.
So so my grandfather stayed in Springfield and ran the hotel group. We built hotels in Decatur, in Rockford, in Aurora. Springfield, so it was very mid, you know, Central Illinois centric. Mm-hmm. He was partners in many others. There's a very famous hotelier out of Missouri, John Q. Hammonds, that built dozens and dozens of hotels, maybe numbering into the hundreds today. Mm-hmm. But they were good buddies, and so I've sensed a lot of influence in my grandfather's entrepreneurship that came from this guy who was probably 15 or 16 years younger than him, Kemmons Wilson, in Memphis, Tennessee. A lot of parallels to the Rainer story as there was to his building this Holiday Inn franchise across America, which, you know, eventually became the largest branded hotel company.
Yeah.
And a kind of a piece of Americana, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the 50s, 60s,
like the McDonald's of hotels. Right?
It was one of those, one of those brands that was like a McDonald's or Coca-Cola. You know, became a real part of the American landscape in the hotel world in, you know, 50s. You know, through the 2000s.
And then in Memphis, any connection to the King?
So there's an interesting story because. Also in Memphis, at around the same time, there was a gentleman, Sam Phillips, who moved to Memphis from this little town of Florence, Alabama, and set up a recording studio called Memphis Recording Services. And I think the year was around 1956. I might be off by a couple years. Uh-huh. Might have been 54, but. A young man strolled into this studio, and for $5 you could cut a little acetate recording, and you could hear yourself played back. And so this was the famous discovery of Elvis Presley.
Mm. Wow!
So
Elvis came in there and did a recording.
As did Carl Perkins, as did Jerry Lee Lewis and Johnny Cash and Roy Orbison. You know, many. His real fame was Sam Phillips was way ahead of his time in that he really loved what at the time was called race music, which was really gospel. Mm-hmm. That emanated from the South, from the Mississippi Delta region. A lot of poor black workers, a lot of poor white farmers, like the Jerry Lee Lewis and Johnny Cash variety.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't have a voice in recording, and so he started recording them, and, you know, guys like Muddy Waters, for instance, and sending them up to Chicago, to the Chess Brothers, who put them on record, Chess Records here in Chicago. And eventually he figured out that in order to really make it in the music business, he had to start stamping his own records under his own label. So he created this iconic Sun Records, which all these recording artists were recorded on.
Wow.
And the funny story is that this relationship, so you've got Sam Phillips in the recording industry, and he had radio stations that before he ever had a recording studio. He had a couple of small radio stations, one in Florence, Alabama. And he talked Mr. Wilson into putting a radio station in this first Holiday Inn. And his vision was that he wanted to have the first radio station that was entirely run, operated. In those days, you had your daily show. Mm-hmm. So it was a series of shows by day. And he wanted it to be entirely African American. But he had to apply for the license with the FCC, and he couldn't get it. And by the time he finally got a license, that idea had already been done. Mm. And so he said, what can I do that's completely different? So he created the first radio station that was all female.
Huh. Oh, wow.
So that's awesome. he just went another. And wow. So it was must have been quite a spectacle. I wish I could have witnessed it. But to have this all-female radio station that was located live inside this first Holiday Inn in Memphis, just to draw people and interest and attention to the hotel as well as to the radio station.
Talk about an icon in diversity, right? I mean, nobody really thought about this stuff back then or cared hardly, right?
And that's where he was way ahead of his time, because he really believed that the music, that this soul type of mm-hmm. and blues should be heard through a wider audience.
Well, was he right, huh? Thank you.
So, yeah, and then he's also famous, Mr. Wilson. He was the one that advised Sam Phillips to sell Elvis's contract for $35,000 back in the day, which was arguably one of the biggest mistakes an entrepreneur could ever make. But Sam was, at the time, was a struggling businessman. I mean, he had radio stations, he had this fledgling recording studio, mm-hmm. but he wasn't hitting it big yet, right? So, I mean, you do what you have to do, and at the time, a $35,000 contract was the largest contract for a single artist in the history of the music business.
Wow.
And so he thought, he hit it big. So,
did your gramps have any stories of interactions with these characters?
I'm sure he had to. The famous stories that run in our family circles is that my grandfather would go fly his airplane to Memphis and pick up what we always refer to as the brass from Holiday Inn. And he would fly them up to Canada, where he had a fishing cabin or a lodge.
Uh-huh.
And they would have their boys' weekends, hunting and fishing, playing cards, and just generally misbehaving. he knew all those people. So I'm sure he would have come, run across Sam Phillips, and maybe Elvis is a stretch, but he was running in those circles at the time.
He was right there in the beginning. All that was pretty wild, and we'll talk later how that blood has run through our buddy Ray here with the rock and roll and the history that he's gotten himself as well. That's awesome. So then from there, tell us where it progressed and how it became what it is today.
So we had on the one hand, we had a garage door, a fledgling little garage door manufacturing company in about 45,000 square feet of production space in Dixon, Illinois. Mm-hmm. We had a little hotel business that was emerging that was based out of Springfield. He created another company, which we called Quickwall, which was basically turning a garage door on its side and running the track overhead to create wall systems for room division. And so every old Holiday Inn, as they got into conventions and meeting space, needed these partitions for room division. Mm-hmm. And so every old Holiday Inn, he created another little company based on seeing that opportunity and having that inside track with the hotels. And so that was a little Springfield manufacturing company. And then he did something very unique where he put a management team in place in Dixon and let them run. So he hired talent, which I think is one of the first essential qualities of a leader is, when you migrate from managing something to leading something, especially in an entrepreneurial track, it's all about the people, right?
Absolutely.
And hiring people that are better than you, that are smarter than you, but as committed as you to the success of an enterprise. And he did that in Dixon and built this, what we always still today refer to as the management team mm-hmm. Concept. And he let them run with it. He provided the capital and they ran the company. And that eventually became, my father became a part of that the year I was born in 1961. Not 15 years later after moving to Dixon, my father became part of that original management team that started growing the company. And then, the other thing, in Kemmons Wilson's book about Holiday Inns, He titled it Half Luck, Half Brains, recognizing that it's not the smartest people who become successful in business, entrepreneurs or otherwise, but it's being in the right place and recognizing an opportunity and then being able to really back that up with just commitment and hard work. The
Absolutely.
Do what it takes kind of mentality that, even if we're not the best today, we'll outwork you kind of thing.
Right.
And that's what that team did. But they were also in the right place at the right time. I mean, post-war economy in the U.S., the 60s were kind of rock and roll. The 70s were good. I mean, there's a lot of things going on in the world in the 70s, but the economy kept expanding. And then for us, the 80s were... really put us on the map in a national way when we created what we call the first raised panel steel door. So it was a major migration from wood garage door product to steel product, base product. That had already happened in the commercial side of our industry, but on the residential side, all garage doors were still pretty predominantly wood.
What year was this?
This was 1980.
Wow, all the way to 1980.
So the truth of the matter is we had a competitor that created the first raised panel steel door.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't have, it's the old Stanley company. And Stanley didn't have distribution. They had great technology.
Mm-hmm.
And they had great innovation. And they created this cool product. But they didn't have a dealer network like we had to push product through. And so the team at the time, I'm in college during this time, so I can't claim any credit for any of this, but they saw it and they recognized the opportunity, and so they were a fast follower. So we were really second, but claimed to be first.
Mm-hmm.
And so we very quickly developed a raised panel steel door. We called it the Decade, the Door of the Decade. Started selling steel raised panel residential doors, and it went crazy. Our business just went into a real boom kind of period throughout the entire decade of the 80s, and we were then able to start establishing distribution, not just regionally. We were already kind of strong in the Midwest and in the Northeast, but it allowed us to expand our distribution nationally.
So as far as if you think about what Ray just said, right, Q, I mean, distribution is everything, right? You can have the greatest ideas in the world and the greatest products in the world, but if you don't have the distribution channel, right, nobody's hearing about it, right?
That's right.
And for my business, this business, and most businesses, it's that hockey stick thing, right? It takes a long time to establish trust and relationships in that distribution network, and once you have it, now you can enter new ideas and new products and solve new problems for that customer and enter another opportunity for business or a division of the business to that network, that distribution network, right? So I mean, the success we're having nowadays, Ray, is exactly that. We're really, our relationship is very strong in the large facilities owners across the country, as well as distribution companies like Exelon, mm-hmm. and different companies we do work for. So our trust levels are very high. And now when we have a new product, they're there to say, hey, well, let us help you pilot that product. Let us help you get that to market, right?
That's right.
20 years ago, I never had that. They'd say, well, we have nothing to do with you. We're not going to take any risk with you. Who the heck are you, right? Today, it's much easier. Just like Rayner, for you guys to introduce a new product, your reputation's strong, your trust levels are so strong with your customers. Big advantage over, you know, let's say Q, you got an idea for a garage door. It's gonna be pretty tough for you, right, personally, to knock on doors to get in front of the big buyers, right? But if you got a partner like Ray, okay, now you got something.
Yeah,
right?
Well, I got you, so you know.
So now, when you come up with an idea for garage doors, you got your guy, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I wanted to allude to, and probably I think it'll be a quality. I mean, at least a good question in my mind. It seems like you come from a pedigree of people who can identify opportunity. And I think as a lot of people who want to be an entrepreneur or want to get in an area of passion, probably that's probably something that they probably lack. They don't necessarily know. They just think they could come up with something and be like, oh, let me try this, right? It seems like your dad saw something, was like, ooh, the doors, let me help out with, you know, so. And I'm assuming that mindset has intricate, or it's in you as well. It's part of your lineage. So how do you identify opportunity as a person who's so successful in a third generation company?
And maybe an idea, Ray. I've heard a lot about different things you're doing. You know, we're good friends, so I hear different ideas. We bounce things off each other, and mm-hmm. I know a lot of cool things that you continue to do to progress. But share with Q and our audience, you know, a couple of things you guys have done since you've been a leader in the business, and things to think differently or take you to the next level.
Sure. So, you know, there's a couple things about, you know, entrepreneurs that, you know, there's a real interesting book called The E-Myth, or the Myth of Entrepreneurialism. And, you know, so, you know, when I think of a true entrepreneur, they have an idea that maybe hasn't really been done before. And they're doing something really new and unique. And there's always opportunity for that. I mean, if you look at things a little bit differently and you see a need that for yourself, you know, this is where Mr. Hammond's, you know, he went on a vacation and was just immensely frustrated with the lack of quality roadside inns. Mm-hmm. And he was just really angered by the fact that if you traveled with kids, and he had a bunch of them, they charged you for every person as opposed to for the room. Mm. And his gripe was, you know, it's the same room, whether I put two people in it or four. Yeah. Why are you charging me more? And so he vowed that he was going to build quality roadside, you know, lodging and never charge more for kids. Huh. It just angered him so, you know, it went against his value system that you would penalize
more
a family.
You have kids, yeah.
Right. So and so it stirred in him a passion to fix it.
Solve the problem.
And then he went around and said, if you join me, if you want to become a franchisee, you know, I've got a business model that will make you a millionaire. Back then it was like the millionaire thing, right? And he one of his things that he was very proud of was that he helped a lot of people become really successful mm-hmm. business people. Because they didn't invent it, right? But they saw the opportunity to jump on board, which is what my grandfather did.
Yeah.
He saw, you know, from his plane, he saw these cute little, you know, yeah. The Holiday Inn sign, the big lit up neon sign with the arrow. You couldn't miss it. You could right. see it from the air. You could probably see it from 100 miles away. And so it's recognizing, you know, an opportunity that's already in front of you that you maybe didn't invent mm-hmm. or you didn't think of, but jumping on the bandwagon, right? And I think the common denominator in being a business person is believing in yourself because of your commitment to the work, right? Mm-hmm. And so first and foremost, believing in yourself and then working hard enough to, you know, it's like waking up hungry every day, or as some people say, you know, waking up unemployed every day. I only eat what I kill, so I gotta go kill something today.
Hungry dogs run faster.
That's right. So, so it's kind of having that mentality.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when you're born into it like I am, right? So, you know, I didn't wasn't necessarily bred, you know, with that entrepreneurial spirit. And so, you know, when you look at family business succession. The hardest one's always the first one, mm-hmm. Because you know, you take a guy like Mr. Wilson with Holiday Inn, or my grandfather with Rayner. They created something; it's kind of part of them, and letting go of that is incredibly difficult. Gary, you'll probably experience this in your lifetime with what you've built here mm-hmm. at Rabine Group, because it's truly something that's part of you, and letting go of that is incredibly tough. So I do a lot of advising of business leaders on, you know, the right way and the proper way and the necessity to let go, because, you know, we're just, you know, first generation wealth creators have a hard time facing their own mortality.
Uh-huh.
And that's just
sure.
a fact, right? And all the research and evidence kind of supports this. And we had the same difficulty in our family business. And that's why so many first generation businesses don't succeed into the second generation, is simply because the handoff is just so rocky. And then you end up with a second generation group of owners, typically siblings, right, that have never had to work together and don't know how to run a business collectively. You know, you just went from having the godfather kind of owner that ran and controlled and, you know, the buck stopped there. Mm-hmm. And now you've got a group of people Well, our business was a little fortunate in that my grandfather had this management team that already was sort of used to running things separate from the owner, right?
Sure.
But in too many cases, for the first time you see a group of successors as siblings that are unable to work well together. And secondly, they feel like they've been handed the prize, and so they don't want to screw it up. Mm-hmm. And so they're risk averse. And that can be symptomatic of second generation leadership teams, is they fail, they just want to keep things the same, which, you know, is likely the thing that's going to kill any business.
So when we see competition across the country, Ray, we see this, right? We see old school companies that have been around for either late and first generation or second generation in our space, sometimes third, but they're old school and they don't want to change. They've been doing it this way for 40, 50, 60, 70 years, and man, this has worked, so they're not changing too fast. Well, I look at that as a dangerous mentality.
Can be very dangerous.
Compared to continuing to have an entrepreneurial mentality where you're constantly pushing the envelope, constantly challenging the industry to get better, and constantly trying to lead your industry. And so, how do you look at those two things?
Well, from my own experience, you know, I had a great example in my father, in that, you know, there's two things about my father and his father before him, and that is, you know, my grandfather's was a pretty old school German guy, right? And he was tough as nails. And he wasn't harder, you know, he was harder on his family than he was anyone else, right? So he just was very demanding and expected a lot. And so, my father and his siblings grew up very humble.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had a real sense of humility to their character. And then secondly, so that, you know, that's actually a very good thing, done right. The second thing was he had this management team in place that my father was a part of. And the example from my father was that he was unafraid of change, in fact, embraced it. So he was not one of those that resisted it. He welcomed it. And so the two things that I think I really learned from my dad was just a real sense of humility, that there are other people with good ideas that might be smarter than you or more capable or might see things that you don't see that you really need to listen to. And then the second thing is, you just got to stay. You can't be afraid to make the hard decisions, and you can't be afraid to change. It's an essential part of reinventing yourself as a company over and over and over again. And what worked yesterday might not be the right solution for tomorrow.
Right.
So you kind of hold on to traditional values, but you have to remember that the people change, the products change, the customers change. I mean, we live in a changing world, and so you're constantly looking for ways to adapt to it, and then also seeking opportunity within those changes. So that's the key, I think, in any longevity from generation to generation, is a willingness to accept change as the one constant, to continue to have the same level of commitment, and being able to make those hard decisions, because they can be truly tough. And that's where, when you think of governance in a family business and you bring in some independent-minded outside mm-hmm. directors, they can help you see where it might be essential to change. And I've got a couple examples of that. There's a thing in a family business, which, you know, I'll simplify. It's basically what we call overcommitment. And it's because we started it, we tried it, and damn it, you know, we're taking the long view.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're going to make sure this thing works. And not realizing, you know, a bad idea for what it is, a bad product, a bad, you know.
And as you get more and more invested in that bad idea, right, you don't want to let go of it.
And you keep doubling down.
We double down, right. We've had this problem before.
And so you can, you know, that's where outsiders can say, it might be time to let go of that. Right?
It's hard for you.
That's right. Because you're just overcommitted to it. And there's some famous examples of that that you can see, repeated in family business circles. So, you know, that, having the the wisdom to listen to others, even when you might not fully agree, mm-hmm. is really a critical thing for continuing to evolve the family business and take some of those next steps.
So the combination of culture in a third generation business, the consistent culture combined with the constant change, right? Can you explain to us about that?
And what we really call that culture is our values, right?
Okay.
I mean, and you know, we are I could spend a whole session just on values. But it's important to know, have a sense.
We may get Ray back because there's a lot more than this. I mean, when you talk about boards, this guy's the best at building boards and understanding what a board should look like for different size companies. Ray's a wealth of information when it comes to values, building values based on the culture of the company, the industry you're in. I mean, we got to get him on again because he's got a lot more to talk about that we can learn from. Right,
So,
get back to you another time when we get time with you.
Having a sense of who you are, what you stand for as a person and a business. And there's been studies that have been, shown that, those companies that have a real sense of who they are mm-hmm. tend to succeed over the long term, right? Even though, like we said before, the people change, the products change, you live in a state of change. The values don't necessarily have to change. And one of our values that is we really identify as a family business, and what's interesting for us is our dealer network, as we look around the country, are small family businesses, right? They're professional installing dealers of garage door products mm-hmm. that sell, install, and service doors in local communities all around the country. They are the backbone of America. They are the small business, and typically a dealer, ranges from 10 to 30 employees between salespeople and installation mm-hmm. technicians and service techs and the like. And so we have family businesses out there. Some of them are third generation, just like we are, mm-hmm. Doing business with a family business, and so we really connect on that level that
right.
we're trying to help them be successful as a small family business, and they are the backbone of who we are.
Absolutely.
Because distribution, as you mentioned, Gary, is king.
Mm-hmm.
And so, that is one of several of our basic values that I think helps us, have clarity in what we're trying to do as we look at current challenges and future opportunities and the kinds of changes that we need to make as a company.
Knowing who you are is so important. I mean, when you think about that, the family business mentality like you have, it could be a culture that you'd love to embrace, and some people won't want to embrace it, right?
Right.
And so, but to clarify that up front while you're hiring and recruiting and building your team, right, and you have a large team today, you got to be clear on it, and there's huge advantages for your team to be part of that environment, because I know how you think, and this family business isn't just your immediate family; it's your team members or your family as well.
That's right.
And so I love to just a quick on that, what the way you think about that.
Yeah, you have to think. We think in terms of extended family,
mm-hmm.
And it really has very little to do with those of us that are identified as shareholders or family member owners, because that's as a third generation chairman, I have shareholders that are, I have a few. My father has two siblings who are still alive, so we have a couple of second generation shareholders. There's a whole bunch of third generation shareholders like myself. Probably 24, 25 of us
wow.
still living, right? And then we have fourth generation shareholders. There's maybe 40 or more of those, and one fifth generation shareholder.
Wow.
So I have over 75 shareholders that are all family. So as a family shareholder group, that's pretty large.
Yeah.
But in terms of our extended family of stakeholders, mm-hmm. that's pretty small. We're nearly 1,000 employees,
mm-hmm.
And then if we look at our dealer network across the country, we have 800 dealers. That's probably 10,000 or more people that
wow.
That rely on Rayner as a primary supplier to make their businesses work. And then you have communities that are involved. We're a large employer in a small community, they're important to us and we're important to them.
You got to go to Dixon sometime. Number one, it's an awesome town. It's beautiful. It's on the river, Rock River. It's a really cool old town, really cool old downtown. And but not far away from downtown is the Rain, you know, basically another unincorporated town of Rainer. It looks to me anyway. You go through this one area and Rainer buildings everywhere, Rainer trucks everywhere. I mean, you guys got a huge campus there today that must be a huge blessing to that community as far as jobs and opportunity that you guys have that isn't common in that marketplace.
That's right. We take that very seriously. It's important to be a responsible and engaged corporate citizen as well. Mm-hmm. And as Dixon goes, we go, and vice versa. So it's important that we take an active role in trying to make our community a great place.
Absolutely. So a couple things I want to touch on for sure is, you know, where did you get this mind of business and entrepreneurship and all that? I mean, what was it like as a kid? I mean, were you pampered as a young Ray the Third? Were you a pampered little guy? Or tell me, because I know you as a working son of a gun. I mean, still today, kind of a work and family is your key, is your thing. Probably faith first, family and work. But
sure.
I mean, you are such a focused guy, busy as can be, and you don't have to be if you don't want to be, but you are.
Well,
where'd you get that mentality? How'd you become?
So for any of the listeners to this that might be in Dixon, they wouldn't, you know, I'd have a hard time convincing them that our family didn't grow up with the silver spoon kind of thing. but actually, I mean, it came from a great family. I'm one of eight kids, so I have six sisters and a brother. So we had this, you know, this large, crazy, dynamic family. Mm-hmm. That was always just in perpetual motion. And, you know, my grandfather was a tough guy, and he believed in being toughest on his kids. And so, you know, my dad didn't make a lot of money. And Rainer wasn't a big company. Mm-hmm. In the 60s and 70s as I was growing up there. In fact, I went to the Catholic high school in the next town, a Central Catholic high school. And no one in that high school even had ever heard of Rainer. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just kind of off the radar.
Right.
You know, I started my first job in the seventh grade. And then I worked, summer jobs and part-time jobs through high school and college, you know, just doing all of the worst jobs that they could think of, right? So, my dad was old school that way, believing that, you know, you worked your way up. But I also, you know, had a lot of great mentors that equally emphasized the importance of education, because my dad really didn't, and my grandfather didn't have a lot to do with, you know, at least higher education, right? They believed in the old school, you know, school of hard knocks. Mm-hmm. I went off to business school, and I was a very good student. I was good at it, right? So I've had a lifelong love of learning. And that's kind of in my own worldview of way of investing in yourself is, you know, you can always learn from others, and you can always, you know, you need to be committed to a lifelong pursuit of learning.
Absolutely.
I went down that road, and as the third generation Ray in the business, there was always this expectation over my head that I would become part of the family business. And I just never knew any better, right? That was my destiny, and I embraced it. I would tell you that for my kids, Cindy and I have taken a little bit different tact in that we also wanted them to grow up with a real sense of humility. You know, I would say in our own family values, the top three are cemented around the idea of gratitude, the idea of humility, and the idea of just being a joyful, loving kind of person,
mm-hmm.
all built in the context of our Christian faith.
And I see that in the highest level, not just with Ray for sure, but his wife Cindy, your kids, they're amazing when it comes to, you know, the positivity in your family and the the love of life is so evident when you're around your family. It's so cool to be a part of, right?
And the great influence, thank you, Gary, and the great influence with Cindy, especially was, you know, making sure that we avoided the temptation of giving our kids everything, right? Uh-huh. And so you have to really be conscious about saying you can't rob them of their desire and ability to earn things and accomplish things for themselves.
Absolutely.
And I think that's a number one mistake that a lot of affluent people mm-hmm. can make, is just making it too easy on their kids. And so all of our kids have had jobs and, you know, had to do some of the, it's kind of our, you know, school of hard knocks, and you gotta earn it kind of thing. I probably learned from my dad and his dad before him. But we, so that's in common. But the thing that's different is that we've always insisted that for our next generation, that the family business was an option, but we left it at that. Mm-hmm. I mean, we really want them to pursue where their dreams and ambitions take them, and try to figure out how we can support that.
I love it.
And if the family business, you know, a lot of it at a young age, you don't know what you don't know as a young adult. And so it might take them some time to discover really what the opportunity might be in the family business. But that discovery process is really what makes it fun.
When I've pushed our kids, I mean, I've pushed them away, but basically said, hey, go find your passion. And you know, this business may not be here when you're in the working world, right? Just didn't, my kids were young, the business was very small, and as it got to be a little bigger and they started going off to college, same thing. You know, hey, you guys do what you want to. If you find passion in this dirty business we're in, love to have you, but you know, you got to love it, otherwise we don't want you. And eventually, you know, a couple of them work for us today, and you know, one's still in high school, and the other one's an attorney somewhere else. But all my kids will not be in this business unless they're passionate about one aspect of it, or one of the companies we start, or whatever. Same thing though. The joy for me, and I think for you, is watching them find their independent passion, right?
Right.
To see them thriving, right, in something that independently they're going to just lead and kick butt and work hard at, right? Maybe not even lead, but be passionate about whatever they do every day. That's the goal, right?
And the thing too is, I'll share a story from Mr. Kemen's book in his 20.
What's the name of that book again? I want to make sure.
I think it's called Half Luck and Half Brains, okay. And it's out of, I think it's out of print, but it's a cool, it's just a very cool old book. But one of his and this guy's just very old school, right? In a great way. But one of his laws is of leadership, or tips to success, is you don't necessarily have to do what you love. And the way you really need to understand that is, if you have a passion, like let's say I have a passion for music, mm-hmm. I don't need to make that my business.
Right.
So you can separate your passions from your work, but you need to love what you do. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, for us, Gary, I mean, paving is paving and garage doors is garage doors, and to our kids, you know, those aren't real sexy businesses, right? Yeah. But just being in business is what's sexy, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, employing people and growing and, you know, having a positive bottom line, and then being able to take your resources and, you know, move them into your foundation and do good things for, you know, needy people and good causes, right? Is what really makes it so rewarding.
Absolutely.
The business is an economic engine, right? Mm-hmm. And it
provides opportunity for so many.
It creates opportunity. And that's what's so compelling about being in business. And then we can, you know, our other passions and our hobbies and the things that we love to do outside of business can be the things that, you know, that we do, you know, is that our businesses allow us to do once we become successful.
Right, and your biggest challenge, and I find this in myself a bit, of course, is you know, so many passions, right? I mean, I love my business, and I love my faith, my family, and I love a lot of different things that I do, and you know, whether it be golf or other things. But this guy, Ray, oh my, Q, if you I may have told you about a few of the things that I get to do with this guy, and Cindy, his wife, but you know, he sets up the coolest motorcycle rides in the world. on an annual basis, and we get to go on them with them. Cheryl and I have been on annual motorcycle rides with Cindy and Ray and another great couple or two that are great friends with us. And it's amazing, right? But he spends time setting this stuff up. Snowmobile trips, he does an annual snowmobile trip. I haven't gotten one of those yet, but one of these days I'm going to get in one of those because I do like to snowmobile as well. All these cool things that you do because you just embrace life, and it's so much fun to watch, Ray. Tell a little about stuff.
It's all, for me, it's very purposeful because, my dad died in 2013, and, you know, when your father passes and he's you know, part of not only your father, but also, you know, a business leader in a community and, mm-hmm. you know, and has this family business dynamic to his life and his death, right, that it really hits you. And, you know, it wakes you up and says, you know, you look around and you kind of take stock. And for me, I've always tried to have great balance where it's all of my time isn't spent in the business at the expense of my family, for instance, mm-hmm. or all of my time isn't spent with my family and business at the expense of my own personal ambitions and passions. And so trying to find that balance has been really core to who the life I'm trying to live with a great deal of purpose. Mm-hmm. And so it's I'm very deliberate about how I spend my time and you know, how I allocate it. And I kind of know I got it about right when, you know, I'm hearing noise about I'm not spending enough time at work, or I'm not, or with customers, or I'm not spending enough time, and I'm not spending enough time at home and with family things, and I'm not, you know, I'm saying no to all these great opportunities of things going around. And you know, Gary, as well as I do, that we get spread pretty thin, right? I mean, there's a lot of opportunities to go do a lot of cool things with a lot of our friend and business network. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes it's a matter of what you say no to.
Yes.
Is as important as what you say yes to. So I have a few things that are really important to me. And I would tell you that one of the themes you already hit on, I mean, I always try to think that my family comes first, and the family stuff that I do with my kids and my wife is highest on the list. And I really try to focus on the experiential things in that, you know, you have all the regular stuff, you know, that you need to be part of and present for. But what really excites me is the experiential things that I love introducing them to opportunities that expand the boundaries of learning mm-hmm. through experience. So my kids, for instance, are all scuba divers, and they learned to scuba dive at the youngest age so that they could be exposed to that incredible ecology and that
right.
incredible world that's underwater, and how important our ecosystem and oceans are to our planet, right? We do, you know, snow skiing is you know, in really any kind of water sport is really hits home with us. Our latest venture is in flying, but not just any flying. We're actually we did a family school of hang gliding, where we learned to be hang gliding pilots at this great little school down in.
Did Cindy step back from that one or no?
See, Cindy is not one that to be left behind.
So, she's doing it too,
so,
huh?
So she is she's gonna at least try it. So. Her deal with me and the family was, you know, it's like snow skiing where you start on the bunny hill.
Mm-hmm.
She said, I'll do the bunny hill part of this, but I have no interest in graduating to the intermediate hill or certainly the double diamond when we're flying off the side of a mountain. So so she started the process, so she's right there with us, strapped into a hang glider and running down the hill.
I've seen some pictures. I mean, it's impressive.
But my kids are, you know, they're actually quite good at it and catch on pretty quick. And so, and then the other category for me, you know, I would tell you that one of the themes has been directly related to the family business has been the importance of the relationship with my brother, who's really my partner in the mm-hmm. business. And I had some great advice.
Todd?
Yes.
Todd's awesome.
So, and I had some great early advice that the success of our generation, this third generation, because remember that the handoff from my grandfather to my dad wasn't great. It was a tough transition from first to second generation. And a friend of mine took me aside and said, the key to the success of second to third generation is the ability for you and your brother to work well together and live well together.
Right.
And so I took that as a sort of a personal challenge and committed that I was going to have a tremendous relationship with my brother, who's 6 years younger than I am. Mm-hmm. We didn't really grow up together. And so it took a lot of effort on my part and his part to say, we're going to have this tremendous brother relationship. And we've, you know, he'd be the first one to admit that I'm a complete pain in the ass as an older brother. But we have a great relationship. And a lot of these experiential things, whether it be motorcycle trips or snowmobile trips or ski trips or football games, you know,
he's right there with you. Crazy things
that we do, we get to do together, which is really pretty special.
Yeah, I've seen you guys together. It's awesome to watch the love for each other you guys have, you know, the older brother to younger brother thing. And that's really cool. So appreciate it. Okay, now, one thing I look at you and Cindy and your family as a representation of strongest in faith as a family. I mean, you know, when Cheryl and I started hanging out with you guys and we pray before meals, I mean, not all our friends do that, and we try to. But either way, your faith is super strong, and your community knows it. Anybody that knows you to, you know that. And it's awesome to watch. You're an inspiration to people that are, you know, maybe they love their faith, but they're not all the way there, maybe, or they're not focused not that much. But when you're around Ray and Cindy, you're focused on it because it's part of some of the conversations we have. It's also the way you live your life. So that's really awesome. And tell me about that. And have you always been like that? And what do you find? And how does your relationships grow because of that? Is that part of your gratitude being a big part of who you are?
So, you know, I would say for me specifically, and this probably is for everybody, you know, faith is really a journey, and you never really get there. Mm-hmm. You die, right? And then you hope you get there, right? So I would say, we do these business exercises, and I'm sure you've been in, you know, a dozen of these where you say, what's your personal mission statement? Mm-hmm. And, you know, how do you really identify yourself? And I would say that my personal mission statement is pretty simple, and that's to get to heaven and to get as many people there with me as I possibly can.
The ones you like or even the ones you don't?
It doesn't matter. So, I hope everybody ends up there, and I hope there's a lot of different paths to get there.
Right.
So,
that's right.
But I would tell you that, my journey has been largely guided by Cindy, the tremendous influence that she's had, because, you know, growing up, I was, you know, pretty, you know, I grew up Catholic in Catholic schools, but a lot of that doesn't stick as a kid, right? Mm-hmm. So, and I think until you have kids of your own, it's hard to really get serious, at least it was for me. And then it's been a journey, and, you know, I'm as big a heathen as you've ever met, and came out of a pretty crazy and wild, young adult, period. Yep. and all that stuff. But I really wanted to be a great example and a world-class dad for my kids. And I realized early with Cindy's help that, being really grounded in faith and bringing kids up in this crazy world isn't getting any easier.
No.
The popular culture isn't really your friend. And so you have to do so much to be a positive counterforce to all of that. And that's what we've tried to be. And it's just a continuing journey. There's days I'm pretty proud of myself, and there's days when I'm pretty not proud of myself. So it's an ongoing thing, and I certainly don't think I'm better than anybody else. But I just hope that by my example and by my actions, more than anything I say, that I can hopefully be an open door and lead people in a positive direction.
You're doing it every day, and Q and I run this a lot when we interview our friends that are leaders and entrepreneurs, and so often, right, it's an unfair, the unfair advantage is a great partner that they've spent their lives with, raised their kids with, and grew their business with. You know, and Quentin's hit it out of the park with Brittany, and I did with Cheryl, and you definitely have with Cindy, right?
Absolutely.
It's an unfair advantage that
if
all of us could be blessed with that, it'd be a different world, right?
For sure. Yeah, I must say it's been a huge advantage for me because Cindy's not only been a great wife, but she's been a great corporate wife. I mean, mm-hmm. she does really, really well with our customers, with employees, in any setting that, you know, I drop her in. She can hold her own.
She can handle herself.
She's
not looking for you to you got to be next to her or anything. She's like, probably Ray, get out here. I got people to meet over here.
Exactly.
Right?
She's very kind and humble herself, and so she's kind of a magnet to people because she has a real sense of empathy and mm-hmm. you know, emotional IQ or whatever you want to call
super
it.
High.
That,
super high.
She can tell when somebody needs a friend and. And she's right there for them.
Yep.
So
I want to make sure we hit a couple things before we're done. And one cool thing that Ray, you know, you've built, and it's been so fun to watch your passion for it is, you know, your history of the rock and roll and where it began and all that with your grandfather and his connections to Memphis and all that. Or what is it, Memphis?
Mm-hmm.
Memphis, yeah. And nowadays the development of the Garage Mahal. Which you know, I've been to a few fundraisers out there so far, and you're having more and more of these fundraisers for the community at what you've built on your property on the Rock River. What an amazing place, Q! You got to get out there. I think I've told you about this before. We got to get you out there, you and Brittany out there sometime, because it's unbelievable. It's got this amazing garage, right? Garage Mahal, of course, with a stage in there, like a real, I mean, not like a real stage, like a real rock and roll stage for a big, big concert.
Mm.
He's got these beautiful garage doors, of course, that open up to the outside and the venue outside. And you know, very, very private, 200 or 300 people is what you have at these concerts, and that's it. You can't sell much more
mm-hmm.
than that. And the intimate atmosphere that he creates with amazing bands, it's so much fun. So you've taken your passion, Ray, for rock and roll and all this to your Garage Mahal.
Sure.
And you're raising money for the community and all different causes I've seen. It's awesome. It's
exactly.
Awesome to watch.
Well, so I have this old hobby of rock and roll. I mean, I played in rock bands, you know, when I was in high school and college, and I'm just a hack musician. I mean, it's
wait,
hard.
Wait, hold on, wait a minute. He says this, but you know, we have done some retreats together, right? With YPO, and when the first retreat we went on, we were at this western like bar. It emulated the old Wild West building kind of, and there was a band that got done playing, and Ray, I'm pretty sure Ray said, "Hey, could you leave some of your stuff here? We might want to grab the stage and play some songs if you guys are done." And they left, what'd they leave? I think they left a guitar.
Well, the ranch had some guitars lying
around.
Oh,
they did, okay.
Yeah.
So we got a mic, guitar, we get on the phones, we pull up songs, and Ray and I are cranking out tunes. Now, I don't have much of a voice, but I sing anyway. Ray can play the guitar, and he can sing.
But Q, a little disclaimer here. You know, Gary's not a big drinker.
Yeah,
but I think we had him drinking that night.
Oh,
maybe a couple. Maybe
yeah,
it's only
a couple
takes,
of those.
It doesn't even take a couple.
So my audience, you know, needs to have been well served.
I love the way you said that.
But I'm telling you what I mean, a guy that can create fun anywhere, right? And all of the our friends who were there just staying around, we just played songs. We got other people. We found out one friend of ours could sing Johnny Cash songs like exactly like Johnny Cash. So Ray's playing the tunes on the guitar, and this guy gets up there and he's cranking out Johnny Cash. I mean, it was so much fun. But this is stuff that just happens when you're around somebody that's got this heart in them.
Well, you get Ray and Raybine together, and it's kind of like Dumb and Dumber, especially if you put a mic in front of us. So,
this is kind of fun. This guy. Okay, sorry about that. Go ahead.
So you know, being in the garage door business. We get to do projects that are super, super cool. Whether it be commercial industrial projects or residential projects. I mean, we put garage doors on some of the most amazing homes in America, right? And some of these amazing homes have just really, really super outrageously cool garage spaces. And so, you know, over the years, you pick up on all these little inspirations. And so I had this vision to build this very interesting carriage house style garage. And I took one... I did a convention for Rainer dealers somewhere in the 2000s. I can't remember now, but we hired Hall & Oates to play.
Wow.
So imagine, you know, Hall & Oates, who are now in the Rock Hall of Fame, mm-hmm. Playing a Rainer garage door in a dealer convention. So I became a fan of Daryl Hall, and he's got a video program that you can see on YouTube called Daryl's House. And it's really neat where he, you know, because of his clout, he brings a lot of classic musicians into his house, and they play their songs, and they play Hall & Oates songs. They just do these collaborations, and you get to see a real diverse group of musicians work together to pull these songs off, and it's fascinating as a musician to watch the level of professionalism and the collaboration, how quickly they pick up on cues and they play. And I thought, man, that would just be really cool to have a space in my garage where we could, you know, create music like that, because I've got a lot of musician friends, and my kids all play instruments. Mm-hmm. It'd just be, you'd keep the noise out of the house in a separate garage space. And the idea started unfolding, and it kind of got carried away. And over the years, I'd started collecting guitars, and so I had all these guitars, and they're stuffed in every closet in the house. And Cindy's like, you know, what can we do to get these guitars? Well, we'll display them in this garage space. You know, when we build the stage out, and you know, I'll build a place to collect guitars, and we'll thin the herd a little bit and get, you know, a realistic number of, you know, neat guitars and cool stuff to look at. And so we created this this space we call the Rock House. So think it's like a miniature house of blues. It's got great guitar memorabilia, and I'm trying to do a definitive history of rock and roll as part of the overall vibe. I got a really cool green room space for my visiting musicians, and it's just
he's got this behind the stage, and you'll explain it better than I do, but he's not good at bragging like I am, but you know, he's got this amazing glass wall basically with these lightsaber like sticks or whatever with like collector guitars on, right?
Yeah,
I mean, and you can see it from the stage, from looking at the stage, as well as
from the players' lounge.
It's got a players' lounge. Got to have a players' lounge if you're going to have a, you know, garage mahal. And behind the stage is a players' lounge. Beautiful, you know, fireplace, bar, and then you're looking again at the backside of that glass wall at the guitars again. It's so awesome.
And where is this?
This is just, it's in our garage.
You're coming with me, buddy. We're going there, right? It's by the Rock River.
So Gary, as we started building this thing out, and you know how these things, you get carried away, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just out of control snowball kind of effect. And so then you actually invited me to a private concert to one of your buddies, had a, you know.
Mike Domek, yeah,
yes.
Is a great concert hall.
So,
concert farm. So
Mike, you know, has this ranch or this farm space with these major league outdoor concerts,
yeah.
And he does it all for charity, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
And so I'd like that's the way. This is a way now that I can take, you know, a cool space that I've created, just on a much smaller scale, a more smaller intimate scale. And use this as a vehicle to not only entertain and have a great time, but also give back to the community. So it's become, you know, thanks to Mike and his group that do such an incredible job with Bunker Hill.
Yes,
it's just a way to bring friends in and musicians. Our model is, you know, musicians are like traveling troubadours, right? And they don't always get treated well from venue to venue. And so I always said that anybody who comes to Ray's and Cindy's place, the Rock House, the musicians are going to get a red carpet treatment, and we're going to treat them like family, mm-hmm. right? And I want their experience to be as great all the guests that come to enjoy, you know, their unique talents, right?
What an amazing gem for the community, right? When you have something like this that can, you know, can bring dollars to the community to solve some problems in the community too, right? Like your place has and will in the future, Mike Domek's place has, and Woodstock and McHenry County. It's awesome.
And in a small town, a little money goes a long way,
yes.
Right? So we don't do real big numbers, but all the proceeds from our events, you know, we direct to need, you know, very worthy and in need charities, mm-hmm. And community, you know, activities that are important to Dixon and our surrounding communities. So it's just a pleasure to use this as a way to give back, because it's a ton of fun. Mm-hmm. We create great events. The artists, I think, love it. We're trying to build a real reputation that, you know, anybody really wants to, you know, have the experience of coming to the Rock House and playing. Hopefully it becomes a thing.
Like Bunker Hill, the word's traveling fast, because you know, people I talk about, you know, that I'm from out there by Domek's place at Bunker Hill. Then also I hear, you heard about the new place, right? The new place at the Rock House, that Ray guy's got going on, right? And you know, it becomes a blast for people that love these venues to know that the money they're spending is going to direct to a charity, right? So right. If it's a couple hundred bucks a ticket, you know, it's a lot cooler than going on there somewhere else where right. It doesn't go to charity, unfortunately. But hey, we can have a lot of fun with this, because you know, we'll, I think there's a lot of conversation we can go into with this guy. He's a world of information, and we just covered the tip of the iceberg here. We're going to go deeper next time if we can get him back. He's a busy guy, tough to get a hold of this guy and get him in here, but we did. So good job there, Q.
Well, you made the call.
We had to work hard on this one.
And you know, you often don't say no to Gary, because he's nothing if not persistent. So.
Well, that's true. Enthusiasm is contagious.
Q's starting to be pretty persistent too.
Well, you know, I go by a statement. As long as you don't call me annoying, then I'll keep going. So,
so that's all you got to do. I have not this guy. Q, you're being annoying now. Then you gotta,
well, Gary, it's a pleasure being here. And thank you for all you do. You are definitely a person that I look up to and admire a lot. So
nice,
thanks for
nice
being my
say.
Friend. And it's a pleasure going down this path with you.
We're going to have a lot of fun, buddy. We've got a lot of road ahead of us, hopefully another 30, 40, 50 years, whatever we can get out of this life, and we're going to do a lot of good things. And Q, so Q goes over things that, is there any questions that you wanted to ask that we didn't ask you that you can think of? Any burning questions for now, or are you going to wait till next time?
Probably have to wait till next time, man.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tell me all the cool Q.
Yeah, man. So I got some amazing takeaways, Quentin's true takeaways, you know, and you definitely spitted some golden nuggets, my friend. I could be honest with you. Like, first off, the one thing I saw, or should I say that I heard, was, and it's a true statement, hiring talent is a great quality of a great leader, you know. And it's a testament to, you know, a third generation company. You know, for, obviously you have great people in addition to your family, your extended family, as you call it. You know, one thing you started, you hit on, you can't identify opportunity when you you can't identify opportunity when you look to solve the problem. And it seems like that's what your family did, and that's, you know, how you all obviously are successful, because you look to what problem can I solve. And I think if any entrepreneur thinks like that, they can see the opportunities for themselves. Keep things the same will likely kill your business, which is true, which means, you know, the only change is only constant, you know, and that's awesome. But you said a quote, man, and this is a nugget I want you all to write down. What worked yesterday might not be the solution for tomorrow. And that's really key. But I think one of the biggest things you said, which is unfair advantage, is having a great partner. And it's a blessing to see that with your family, and I've seen that with Gary and everybody else that I've met, that there's always a great marriage and a great family that is the reason why success is there. So I'm excited, man. And Ray, if I could get closer to you, I feel like I'm on top of the world. So I'm gonna keep knocking on your door too. So
Ray, thanks for being here. Really appreciate it. And this is a great one for history for Ditch Digger CEO.
Yeah, and we'll see you all next time on Ditch Digger CEO.
See ya.
Thanks, guys.
If you enjoy this show, please share with anyone else you think will find value here. And please go to our website, ditchdiggerceo.com, for show notes, links, video clips, and more nuggets of entrepreneurial wisdom. Don't forget to follow me on social media at DitchDiggerCEO and at Gary Rabine. If you listen to our show and want to become more successful, you will become more successful. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Lord, I was called Ditch Digger Man, paving for a living and doing the best I can. Discovered entrepreneurship, scaling business plans. Then I became the CEO man. We're blessed to build a business in America, where soldiers fight for our freedom every day. Dad's work ethic was taught from the seat of a gravel truck, rolling down Highway 31. Lord, I was called Ditch Digger Man, paving for a living and doing the best I can. Discovered entrepreneurship, scaling business plans. Then I became the CEO man.